We're in the book of Ecclesiastes. Turn with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Let's do a little reviewing. Now, hopefully by the end of the week, we'll have these five ground rules for living memorized. But if you can't memorize, or if you haven't got it memorized, and you can't recite it without looking at your notes, peek. But I'd like you to, one at a time, just kind of stand up. Who will give us rule number one? Go ahead.
Mortality is a 100%.
That's good. And what's the rest of it? Mortality is 100%.
And life at best is brief.
Good. You'll get a little help on that one. Let's how about number two? Number two is relatively easy.
Vanity.
What about vanity? All right, who can help her? All the work of man's hand is vanity. All right, rule number three. It's a little more complicated. Three and four and five, I guess, a little harder to get. Who can try one? If you can't, just read it. Oh, here's one that can get it.
For reasons of his own, God has claimed man to be worth something, to be of worth.
That is exactly right. That's excellent. For reasons all of his own, God has declared man to be of worth. Rule number four. Who'll try it for us? Exactly. Significance in life is to be found in giving ourselves in exchange for that for which God gave himself in exchange. Rule number five. Yes, thank you. For good or for bad, for the Christian and non-Christian alike, what you do here on earth appreciably affects eternity. The five ground rules for living. Now remember, we said these were the irreducible minimums of life. We don't get a chance to vote on them. They're not negotiable. All we get to do is respond to them. And the way we respond will affect the kind of life we live, whether it's fulfilled or whether it is empty and void of meaning and purpose. Now, you remember that we said that Psalms speaks to the what? Proverbs speaks to the? And Ecclesiastes speaks to the mind. And so Solomon is attacking our minds. He says, I want you to think. And if in our sessions together, you have to say to yourself, boy, I've got to think hard about that, then Solomon has a mission accomplished. He wants us to think. He says, I want you to grab a hold of these issues of life and think about them. So if you find yourself kind of straining in the gray matter, that's exactly what Solomon wants. Exercise that muscle called our mind. I don't know if it's called a muscle or not, but we're going to call it that for now, okay? Now, the book of Ecclesiastes divides itself into three parts. Chapters 1 through 3, A Wise Man's Outlook. Chapters 4 through 9, A Wise Man's Experiences. In chapters 10 through 12, A Wise Man's Actions. 1 through 3, his outlook. 4 to 9, his experiences. 10 through 12, his actions. Now here in chapter 1, I've divided it into three parts. You know, after all, you learn when you do any message preparation, you've got to have 3 points in a poem. I'm terrible on poems, but I work hard on the 3 points. So we've got three sections out of the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1. Verses 1 and 2 is the proposition. Verses 3 through 11, the prologue. And 12 through 18, purposelessness. I don't even know if the word exists, but I've coined it, purposelessness. All right? Before we look at it, let's unite our hearts together in a word of prayer. Our Father, I remember how a group of Greeks came to the disciples and said, Sirs, we would see Jesus. And that's why we've gathered together here these days at Glen Eyrie, to catch a fresh glimpse of his person, to find him touching our lives in a way that'll change us from the inside out. Even as has already been prayed, help us to be doers of the word and not hearers only, living in self-deception. God, we are incapable of creating goodness out of our own lives. We just cannot muster up good on our own. We look to you to work in us, to will, and to do of your good pleasure. We long for it and recognize that it's a work that belongs to you, all because of Jesus. Amen. The proposition, verses 1 and 2. In verse 1, we meet the preacher. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Koleth is the word for preacher in the Hebrew, and maybe your translation has that. The words of Koleth. He's identified for us. He is the son of David, the king of Jerusalem. So we know who the son of David, the king of Jerusalem is. Doesn't take a great deal of deduction to come to the conclusion that this is Solomon. And as you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, you find there are many similarities to the book of Proverbs. Now in verse 2, we find the purpose of the book. He gives it to us at the outset. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. This word vanity means vapor or breath. You remember we quoted from the book of James last night, James 4:14, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. That's the word vanity. For what is your life? It is even vanity that appears for just a little time and it is gone. It indicates the fruitlessness, I should say, the aimlessness, the emptiness of everything that takes place here on earth. Everything is vanity. All of life is transitory. We're here but for a moment. Now I want you to notice here that this is not written by a soured man passed over by the world. This is written by a brilliant king with unlimited resources. We talked about that last night. He had vast wealth, power, and all kinds of gray matter. He was a wise, brilliant, good man. Those of you who are Presbyterians, tell me, what is the first question and answer of the Shorter Catechism? Come on. What is the chief end of man? And the answer is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. What is the chief end of man? The book of Ecclesiastes tells us what the chief end of man is not. It is not to be found in wisdom. It is not to be found in pleasure. The chief end of man is not to be found in riches and honor. It is, in short, is not to be found in what this world has to offer. Now let's note it at the outset, as we get started in the book, that any worldview that does not rise above the horizon of man is doomed to meaninglessness and frustration. To view personal happiness or enjoyment as life's greatest good, says Solomon, is nothing but sheer folly. Happiness is a byproduct of a higher goal. It's a goal rooted in God, and without that stabilizing relationship with God, happiness is impossible. The pursuit of happiness, as an end in itself, involves the absurdity of self-deification. I have a good friend who's in consulting. And he and I were going over the ground rules of living one day, and a couple of months ago, he was asked by AT&T to try out for the running of a series of seminars for their management across the United States on purpose in life. And he and a number of other consultants went and gave to the top management of AT&T how they were going to present this material, and he told me on the phone a couple of days ago that when he went, he just simply gave them Solomon's five ground rules for living. And as a result, they gave him the job. Isn't that interesting? Because you see, AT&T and all corporate structures understand that in order to be motivated, you've got to have purpose. The person without purpose is not motivated in life. So how do you instill motivation? He said, you got to come to grips with what Solomon said. They listened to it and said, you got yourself a job. Isn't that interesting? Transient mortals are mere creatures, and they derive their importance solely from their relationship with their Creator. Now, you remember last night we talked a little bit about existentialism. Existentialism understands the vanity of life. It understands that life has no moorings. We're adrift. We don't know from whence we came to where we're going. The conclusion of the existentialist is purpose is to be found in hedonism. It is the thesis of Solomon that hedonism will lead to despair. It cannot, in the final analysis, produce purpose and meaning. All is vanity, said the preacher, utterly vain. In verses 3 through 11 is the prologue. In these verses, he elaborates on the theme. In verses 3 through 7, we note that the thesis is there's nowhere to go. Verses 3 through 7. Let me read them to you. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteneth to the place where it arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth around about to the north, and whirleth about continuously. The wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Now Solomon uses these four illustrations to point to the aimlessness of life. Everything is the same, he says. Now I want to pause here for a moment and note with you that the Bible teaches that life is not cyclical, life is linear. Now hang on with me here for a moment as we understand this. The Bible teaches that you had a time when you were born and a time when you will die. And when you die, you move into eternity. You don't come back to be reborn again. Your life is not cyclical, it is linear. There was a time when you were not, there is a time when you came into existence, and you will always be in existence forever and ever and ever. For good or for bad, that's the way it's going to be. You don't get a chance to vote on it. You didn't get a chance to vote on coming into the world the first time. You don't get a chance to vote on the fact that you'll live forever. Life, says the Bible, is linear. It never ends. Now, gang, one of the ways that you can tell the difference between a religion of reason and a religion of revelation is whether or not they understand that life is linear. Now, there are two great religions of the world. All of the other religions simply borrow from these two great religions. Do you know what they are? A little test in comparative religions this evening. What are the two mother religions of the world? One born out of reason, the other born out of revelation. Anybody want to venture a guess? No, not Islam. We'll come to Islam in a moment. Judaism was certainly one of them. And Hinduism is the other. Judaism and Hinduism. You see, Hinduism is a religion of reason. And the reason we know it is so is that they have borrowed from life as they see it. Everything in life is cyclical, says the author. You look at it. The sun comes up, the sun goes down. The sun comes up, it goes down. People die, they're born, they die. They're born, they die. Everything looks cyclical. The wind comes in one direction and it goes to the other. The rain comes out of the ocean and goes to the sky and it comes out. Everything is cyclical. And so reason says life is cyclical also. And the conclusion to which they come, therefore, is when you are born, you die, and then you're reborn, and you die in what they call the wheel of karma. And you go round and round and round, and reason would lead you to believe that that's the way it is, because that's what the mind tells you as you look at the data of existence. Buddhism was a reformation movement in Hinduism. Taoism and all of the religions of the Orient simply borrow that thesis. Christianity is simply an extension of Judaism. Islam was a reform movement in Christianity, in Judaism. Islam was to its day what Mormonism is to our day. And all of it borrows from the mother religion. And we know that life is linear, not because we observe it through reason, but because we understand it through revelation. The Bible teaches it to be so. But everything in life, says Solomon, apart from your existence, is cyclical. The sun comes up out of the east, and it sets in the west, and you wait a few hours, and behold, here it comes again out of the east. And you follow it around, and there it goes. The rain comes down, and it fills the moat, and the moat goes down into the creek, and the creek goes to the river, and the river goes to the ocean, and the ocean gives the water back to the sky, and it drops on us again, and it just goes round and round and round and round. Everything is the same. Everything is changing. Solomon says it is both predictable and monotonous. Now I'm going to skip verse 8. Remember verses 3 through 7, nowhere to go. Verses 9 through 11, nothing new. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of those things that are to come with those that come after. You see, man seeks to break out of this cycle by trying to discover something new, only to find out that it wasn't new after all. We see it in science. We say, he made a great discovery. And then he thinks about it, discovery. All he did was discover what had already been. It wasn't anything new. It had always been. He just discovered it. Notice what he says here in verse 11. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of those things that are to come with those that shall come after. You see, what happened, what he's saying here is, we get a brand new thought, and we say, this is a new thought. Why? Because generations ago, the guy that had thought about it died, and everybody forgot that he thought about it, because his works died with him. And so when you think about it, you say, huh, this is a brand new idea. One new at all, says Solomon. And that guy who thought about it, he thought, man, I'm the first guy. But the fact of the matter is, back before him was another guy who thought about it. He died. The thought died with him. And you're going to think, boy, my thought is such a great thought. Nobody's had a thought like this before. And you're going to die, and your thought will die with you. In a few years from now, somebody's going to come up with the same idea and say, a brand new idea. Nothing is new, he says. Nothing under the sun. And therefore, he says in verse 8, we're never satisfied. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. See, the lack of newness and the cyclical nature of all things leaves man empty and unsatisfied. Labor, says Solomon, not rest, is our lot in life. Note that in every area of our life, our appetites are insatiable. They can never be satisfied. In verses 3 through 7, he says everything is constantly changing. We just get out of summer and we go to fall. We just get into fall, we go into winter. We get into winter, we go to spring. We get into spring, we go to summer again. Round and round and round and round we go. In verses 9 and 11, he says, nothing changes, there's nothing new. Now, these seem to contradict each other. All they simply do is add to the dilemma. Man, says Solomon, is born to be discontent. He cannot, by his very nature, ever be satisfied. Have you ever thought about it? Take, for example, wealth. Have you ever met a man who said, I am rich? You know, I never have. I've never met a man who said, you know, I am filthy rich. Never met that kind of a man. I've met a lot of people who said, I'm really poor. Never met an individual who said, I am rich. You know why? Because it doesn't matter how much we get, we want just a little bit more. That's the way we're created. You know, we applauded the food tonight, didn't we? Oh, good chow. And I sit down there in the King James, and I belly up there at the trough until I can't eat anymore. But I know that when I am done, it's just a matter of hours before I'm ready to go back and try it one more time. Isn't that true? And that's true in every area of our lives. Food, sex, ambition, wealth, power, it matters not what it is. We see this in our interpersonal relationships, don't we? We come to an individual and we say, how are you? Oh, fine, just fine, fine, just fine. And we know they're not fine. They're filled with hurt and pain and worry and anxiety and frustration. But we don't want to hear it, and they know we don't want to hear it. Every so often, we hear somebody who answers us honestly. Oh, I got rheumatism in my big toe. And they go on, and we think, good grief, what have I ever had that? I shouldn't have asked him. Mercy, I shouldn't have asked him. Isn't that right? And so we learn. How are you doing? I'm just fine, just fine. But we're not. A lot of hurt. Solomon says that just below the surface of every individual is an incredible rot that produces hurt and pain and anguish beyond our ability to describe. Now, I want you to notice that beginning with verse 12, he changes. The prologue lays out the theme of the book. This is a statement of fact. There are no pronouns. No I, me, my, mine, we, us, they. They're missing. Notice what happens at verse 12 following. He now begins to relate his own experiences. And his conclusion in verses 12 through 18, he concludes with the prologue, purposelessness. In verses 12, we see that he's frustrated in doing. In 16 through 18, we see that he's frustrated in thinking. And in verse 15, we see he's frustrated by predeterminism. Let's read verses 12 through 14. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Notice here, Solomon is now relating his experiences. I, the preacher, am now talking. Verses 13 and 14. And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Man's first quest with his wisdom is to know why God has placed him in the world to be exercised by sore travail. Why, says our mind, are we here? I have to tell you, this is the thing that brought me to Christ. I didn't understand the book of Ecclesiastes. I didn't know Genesis from Revelation. I didn't know come here from Sikkim when it comes to the Bible. But I knew that down deep in my soul was a hurt and an emptiness and a void, and I didn't understand how it could be filled. And boy, I started asking. I asked around, and the older I got, the more intense it became. And I grabbed people, and I say, how do you fill the void in your life? And they say, blankety blank if I know. And one day I met a man who said, I think I got the answer for you. And it was in Jesus. But you know, this longing to know purpose, it's been with us since the beginning of time. I ran across a quote, and the reason I want to quote it to you, because it was written by a guy exactly 100 years ago. His name is Ernest Renan. Don't ask me who the guy is. He's just a guy. And this is what he says. That was kind of profound, wasn't it? Thank you. Let me read what he said. In short, God has taken little interest in man, since he has put him in a false position by giving him the task of concerning himself with wisdom, but has allotted to him a finite destiny, which is the same for fool and sage, man and beast, and this within a society where what happens is opposed to justice and reason. Why? Why, says the thinking man, does God give travail? Why does he give purposelessness to man? I'll tell you why. For the same reason that God gave us the law. Do you remember what the hymn writer said? 'Twas grace that made my heart to fear, and grace my fear relieved. How did God make our hearts pure with grace. Through the law and through the emptiness of the soul. And the reason God gave us this tremendous sense of void and purposeless in our lives is to drive us to the cross so that we can meet Jesus. For he and he alone can fill that void. And I want you to understand that it cannot be ascertained by the natural man. Reason cannot produce it. Paul says the same thing in 2 Corinthians 2:14. But the natural man receives not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. Neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned. Reason will lead you to believe that life is cyclical and without purpose. Revelation will lead you to believe that life is linear and has its purpose by meeting the Creator God of the universe. In verses 16 through 18, he's frustrated in his thinking. Let me read this to you. I commune with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart hath great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief. And he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Solomon decides to study wisdom and its opposite, folly. What he did was he took the gift that God gave to him. For God says, Solomon says, God gave me wisdom. So he says, I think I'll do is take this gift and see if it can help me out of my dilemma. His conclusion, rather than helping him, it simply adds to his hurt. Notice verse 18. For much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. What happens is he sees more that he cannot know, and what he sees he cannot correct. That's our lot in life, isn't it? We look out in the starlit night and we say, oh, I wonder what is beyond those stars. Boy, that's wonderful. And so we work very carefully and we get ourselves a telescope and we look at it and we say, oh, boy, more stars. I wonder what's beyond those. And so we build these space shuttles and we get them out. We're going to put a big deal on it. We look at it. More stars. And all it does is just show us that there's more out there that we do not know. And we're increasing in our knowledge at a rapid rate. And everything we learn, it just simply lets us know that we're on the edge of that which we do not know. What he's saying is there is more than the mind can ever understand. And, he says, what we understand, we cannot correct. I'm sure this has been your experience. You sit there behind the boob tube and you watch the evening news. In one scene, they take this decimated little child who's got nothing but skin and bones over in Bangladesh and show it to you. And the next moment, somebody's blowing somebody else's head off in war. And the next moment, you see, and you just look at this and you just wilt inside of yourselves with anguish, because there's not a thing you can do about it. You reach out there and you understand that it is all beyond your ability to change it. And he says in verse 17, it is madness. Sheer madness. That's, by the way, the word for derangement. He says it takes the thinking man's mind and it causes him just to go out of his mind. Not only that, he says in verse 15, he's frustrated by predeterminism. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. And what he's saying here in verse 15 is, we can't right the wrongs, and the wrongs are without number. In short, we cannot control our circumstances. Now let's pause and note that predeterminism or predestination is not a doctrine unique to Christianity. Every religion of the world understands that this is so. And the existentialist understands that it is so. Even reason leads you to understand that that is the way it is. All you have to do is just take a cursory look at your own life and you realize you're out of control. Think about it with me for a moment. Did you decide the day you were going to be born? Yes or no? Did you decide who your parents are going to be? Did you decide your sex? How about the color of your skin? And we could go on and on and on. And every time you say, no, 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 no. Things are out of control. Circumstances come into your lives. You don't have any control over it. Do you decide whether you're going to get cancer or not? No. When you go home in your automobile and somebody comes passing on the wrong side of the road and that's the end of you. Did you make that decision? Anybody ask you to vote? No. You're flying home on that airplane and all of a sudden the pilot says, this is it. Whoa, wait, I want to vote on this. Sorry, friend. Even I didn't get to vote. Isn't that right? We're out of control. We can't right the wrongs, and the wrongs are without number. See, the problem, the big problem, is you can't change what's going on inside of an individual. Take India, for example. We look at India and we say, tremendous poverty and needs. Let's pour resources into India and help them, because we have plenty and they have so little. And then as we pour our resources into India, we begin to realize that in a given year, 50% of India's grain crop is eaten by rats, because rats are sacred. Because remember, life is cyclical. And you don't kill the rat because you might be killing your grandmother. And you laugh, but that's where they live. And you understand that the wrongs in the world are so terrible and so gargantuan. There's nothing you can do about it. And my friend, the lesson for us is simply that we cannot look to man's solutions for those solutions that can only come from God. And we can pour our technology and we can pour our grain and we can pour our resources into these countries, but we've got to understand that they are not a generic solution. Now, the Bible teaches us to be generous. As a matter of fact, Ecclesiastes 11 talks about that. Cast thy bread upon the waters, for afterward it'll return. But let's understand that as we give, we cannot change the world by our generosity. It just cannot be. The goal of missions has got to be Christ, because man is out of control and he cannot right his wrongs. There's no way in the world we can lift ourselves up by our bootstraps. The law of gravity prohibits it. Only Jesus can make the crooked straight. And let us not deceive ourselves into believing that the answer is in the social gospel, or that it is in liberation theology, or that if we had a new economic order, or if we had this or that, that this would be the answer. It is vanity, says Solomon. Vanity, vanity, vanity. The only hope for a broken humanity is a proper relationship with the living God. Only Christ, and Christ alone. Amen? Now, tomorrow morning, we'll take chapter 3. We're not going to be able to cover all the chapters of Ecclesiastes, so I'm just picking out some of my favorites. Chapter 4, tomorrow night. 3 is probably the best known of all the chapters in the book of Ecclesiastes. Read it over. That'll be tomorrow morning, and then chapter 4 tomorrow night. I'll turn it over to you, Dave.